Fed can just print more money out of thin air, but the government's always going to be in debt to the Fed. Oh.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Dangerous World Podcast, a special JFK edition. November 22nd is the day that JFK was killed in Dallas in 1963, and Ghost had the great idea to do a little swap cast of sorts with a fella that he found called Corey Hughes. And I never heard of this dude before, but man, is he knowledgeable, and we got some really, really interesting information out of him, some stuff that I'd never heard before. So I hope that this will strike your fancy. Haven't seen many people talking about JFK today. With all these conspiracy people, maybe it's a topic that's tired for a lot of us, but this is a completely new look at it. Honestly, I'm not saying that, just to try to get listens or whatever. You guys are already here, so I'm not selling it to you. It's just wildly interesting. Corey seems to really know his stuff. You'll find out some information about him that kind of gives him more credibility. I don't want to spoil anything. There's just a ton of information here. I have this book, which I mentioned, I believe, in the last episode. Meant to release this earlier today, but had some difficulties with the computer, believe it or not. So it's coming out a little late. Thanks to Ghost for recording on his end and shooting me the file for cunt, because that came out late as well. So just a real knife fight over here at the Dean House. But I had this book that I mentioned called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. And there's a little section in there that talks about the possible reason of JFK being murdered, assassinated, was because he was about to disclose some information about NASA, the joining of the U.S. and Russian space forces, right? Space technologies and all that stuff. And I guess, allegedly, the idea here is that Russia was planning to ignore JFK, but then, 10 days before his death, I think it's Khrushchev that said, let's move forward and let's try and join, let's team up with the U.S. And that's no good for the global elite. So it's an interesting theory, but that's not one that Mr. Corey Hughes agrees with, and he has some, like I said, wild information. I'm not going to take too much time in this intro. This is already coming out late. Full version on my Patreon or Ghost's Patreon. If you haven't signed up for either one, take your pick, man. I mean, Ghost is a newer podcast, and he would appreciate the support over there. So I really, really appreciate support over here as well, but I mean, you're going to get the same content, bonus content of this episode, no matter where you go. So I really appreciate just, the time that people take, man. Want to give you a little extra bonus content for this little holiday weekend. Thanksgiving in just 2 days. Black Friday is always a shit show. I don't know how many of y'all go out. Probably not many, because this community is full of people that are like, oh, I don't like to go out and be around the people. It's like, I get it, but come on. We need to have our own personalities here. Everyone seems to like think the same way in this conspiracy world. And I'm not going to start ranting about that, okay? But this is a wild episode. I hope that you guys enjoy it. I usually don't like touching these topics that people have just beaten to death. This is not that. This is very, very new stuff. And all the stuff that I know about JFK, this was new. Entirely new stuff to me. So I hope you enjoy it. Check out the Patreon, patreon.com/dangerousworldpodcast. 45 additional minutes here and over on my Third Eye Podcast Patreon as well. And, we'll see what's up. Just check it out. Dangerousworldstore.com, gearing up for the holidays. Not telling you to order anything, because sometimes shit takes me a while, but I'm going to get back in gear with that store. And I just, again, can't thank you enough. I hope that you enjoy this episode. let's roll into it with my buddy Ghost over there at My Third Eye and the great Corey Hughes, the great and powerful Corey Hughes, as Joe Rogan would say. Let's get into it. Here we go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to My Third Eye. Today, I am joined by Ryan Dean. You all know who he is from Dangerous World Podcast, and Corey Hughes from CoreyHughes.org. We are going to discuss the JFK assassination. So how are you, Corey?
I'm good. Thank you.
Let people know where they can find your work.
Sure. All my stuff is at CoreyHughes.org. That's pretty much the best place because it has links to all my videos and podcasts and whatnot.
Awesome. Ryan, how are you today?
Good, man. Same old stuff. Just another good day to, be learning about some new information.
Yes, absolutely.
How are you? No one ever asks you how you are.
I'm always good. I mean, I don't know. I try not to ever have bad days, but when I do, they are the shittiest days on the planet. But I try not to let shit bother me. You know what I mean? But yeah, I'm doing good. Other than the puppy's having a little bit of a thing today. So
we were rocking a Green Bay shirt. They just had an embarrassing performance against who was it? The Titans. That was god awful. Yeah. Hey, you win some, you lose some.
Apparently, we're losing a lot. So
yeah,
all good. So where do you want to start, Corey?
Anywhere you like. I can pick up pretty much from whatever questions you have, we can run with.
Well, let's start with the beginning. You break down your case, and we have questions. We'll jump in, and we'll go from there.
Should we let the people know what we're talking about here?
Well, I did say the JFK assassination.
Okay, yeah, because that's it's definitely very interesting, significant for today as well. You know, the day that this episode's coming out here, so. Yeah, man, it's interesting stuff. And I haven't heard what you get into here, Corey. So I'm really pumped to hear some information I haven't heard about this, man. So yeah, wherever you think you want to start.
Okay. So, most people, when they talk about the Kennedy assassination and researchers who get into the Kennedy assassination, one thing I find is that all of them seem to study just the Kennedy assassination. And the Kennedy assassination is like one piece of a much larger puzzle. And so if you really want to understand the Kennedy assassination, for me, it goes back to like the late 1800s. And all through World War I, World War II, and then even after Kennedy, you can continue in world events tracking things that were the direct result of the Kennedy assassination, right? Like through Iran-Contra, Oklahoma City, 9/11, you know, all these things, right? These are not like, to me, individual events. These are all continuations of the same operation, right? So, for me, when you really start to understand who was behind the assassination and how it was pulled off, it really comes down to the study of relationships, right? And when you start to study relationships, you know, you can really how big do you think the connection map surrounding Jeffrey Epstein is? I mean, in the thousands, right? And so when you get into history, really history is seemingly this long study of relationships. And when you study the relationships that are directly responsible for the Kennedy assassination, you'll find that the motivations and the mindset and the ideologies of the people who were behind it really go back quite some distance. And so when most people start to study Kennedy and they really don't seem to understand up from down, it's because they don't understand the mechanism by which the assassination was pulled off, right? And so you have to think, all the guys involved in the assassination, particularly the shooters and the handlers above them, all of them were working with the mafia and with the CIA and with the FBI. And in working with all those organizations who really are fundamentally one organization, right, especially in 1963, you really come to find that there are outside influences that have been kind of co-opted our country that have been in place for at least 100 years. And so when people blame the CIA or the FBI, you know, to me, it's a joke because who are the forces that are controlling those organizations? You know, And I'll tell you that their interests are not in America. They're not in continuing the American dream or supporting American, the American people or any of that stuff. Right. So it all kind of came to a head with the Kennedy assassination. And ultimately, Kennedy was killed over Israel and their need for the nuclear bomb. Kennedy's number one priority going back to 1960 when he became president was nuclear deproliferation, right? Getting rid of nukes. And he was heavily involved in talks with Khrushchev on back channels on getting rid of nukes, right? But of course, you have savages on both sides. Neither men could get anything done with the, you know, with the CIA infrastructure surrounding him, and in the Soviet Union with the KGB infrastructure and all the powerful people other than Khrushchev. Those two guys weren't ever going to be able to work together on any meaningful level because of the forces behind them, right?
So. Right. I was going to actually ask you, Corey, you know, you're mentioning, you know, the mob, you know, Vegas interests and things like this, which I'm assuming are kind of, you know, linked. The CIA, the FBI, are they acting against the government or are they acting on behalf of the government in this instance here?
What day is it? You know, on Mondays, they're working with the government. On Wednesdays, they're working against the government. So, you know, it's they were definitely against Kennedy. So, like I said, it's a study of relationships, and you have to go back to like the 1940s to understand the relationship between the government and the mob. When, you know, Lucky Luciano controlled the docks, and, you know, Albert Anastasia controlled the docks and the longshoremen and all those, and all the unions up there. And so basically the government was concerned about Nazi spies like smuggling stuff into the country. And how do you get stuff into the country in the 1940s, you get it in the country through the docks, right? Oh, and that was controlled by the mob across the country. Like, there were no docks in America that were not controlled by the mafia in the 1940s. And that held true through the 1960s and probably just fell apart in the 1970s. So, yeah, the government had no choice but to go to the fucking mob. And who'd they go to? They went to Lucky Luciano, who really was not in charge of anything. I mean, he was a boss for sure, but he was a front boss for a guy named Meyer Lansky. And, and when you think about it, like Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano, Albert Anastasia, Lepke Buckalter, these guys were all Jews. These guys were Italians, but they were not Sicilian Italians. And most people don't understand this about the mob. Most people like look at The Godfather and it's like, you know, those are portrayals of Sicilians. Those are not portrayals of just Italians in general, right? And so the vast majority of the mob really had never been controlled by Sicilians ever. Between 1921 and 1931, you had Salvatore Maranzano, who was a boss out in New York, and Joe Masseria was his number two. And he got whacked in 1931 by Meyer Lansky. Okay. Meyer Lansky sent Albert Anastasia and all those guys I just mentioned to go take out Sal Maranzano. And when they did, in 1931, basically Jews took control of the mob. And that was basically the mob boss of all time was Meyer Lansky from 31 through the late 70s when he went on the run. And all the names you hear, Giancana, Trafficante, all these guys were front bosses ultimately. And so the image that most people have of the United States mafia is totally wrong. And so that's a crucial piece of the puzzle in understanding why the U.S. mafia would be working with the Israelis. And so the Israelis had been working with the fucking mob since 1946. You know, there had been some talks going back to 45 between Ben-Gurion and Meyer Lansky. But in 46, they kind of sealed the relationship by sending a guy named Reuven Daphne to Los Angeles. And Reuven Daphne met with Bugsy Siegel. And Bugsy Siegel, another Jew, right? Italian Jew.
Kazarians though, right? I understand that.
That's a whole different conversation. That's okay. A vast, vast conversation right there. So
sure. I was just sure, saying, yeah. Just ultimately. For sake of, you know, and I'm not like overly sensitive about shit, but like the whole idea that like the Jews are ruining, you know, the whole world for everybody else. It's a specific sect.
Right,
people, right? I mean, like, it's a very interesting situation.
Yeah, right. You're talking about, like, ultimately the Zionists.
And, yes, exactly.
Right. And that becomes a very complicated conversation because in the modern day world, see, when you look at what Zionism is, and that to me goes back to 1897 and Theodor Herzl and 1894 and, like, the Dreyfus Affair, which inspired Herzl. But ultimately, Herzl was a complete fucking rabid anti-Semite to himself. Like, he believed that there were two distinct classes of Jews, that there were the upper class aristocratic Jews who control everything and openly admit it and who are total cunts. And then there are the regular Jews out there in the world who are just, you know, might not even be very religious, but they're born of Jewish families. Yeah. And that makes up really the majority of Jewish people, right? And they knew this when they kind of formulated political Zionism, and they really had no respect, or they had a lot of disdain for the average Jew, because they felt that they were kind of a poor representation of the brand. Mm. It's really kind of how, when you read Herzl's diaries, he befriended and fostered anti-Semitism amongst non-Jews because he hoped to undermine Jewish wealth all over the world. And once Jews felt like they were undermined in every country around the world, then that would cause such a fervor for there to create a state of Israel for all the Jews to go and return to, right? So these Zionists, these early Zionists, really instigated the anti-Semitism, and they continue it to this very day. Organizations like the ADL, they continue to foster anti-Semitism, and they go, ha, see, anti-Semite, we're here to save the fucking day. And
same thing with BLM.
Yeah, same thing with BLM. It's a total fucking ploy. But the bottom, but the difference is the ADL are true they're true ideologues. I mean, they're fucking lunatics at heart. They're the ultimate in racists, period. They're Jewish supremacists of the highest degree, which is kind of funny because modern day Jews are not descended from the Israelites. They're descended from the Khazarians. Yes. They're descended from the Khazars. They're descendants of converts, right? And so we get this moral high ground from the entire, seemingly the entire world of Jewish people. And they're not even descendant from the fucking people they claim. Their origins are not what they claim. They're a bunch of fucking phonies. Sorry, but that's the reality. Like, they're all, it's like the analogy I'll give is like that episode of South Park when Cartman went off and became a rapper. And then he's like, y'all just hate me because I'm black. Right.
Well, hey, I'll take it a step further. Have you seen where Cartman becomes a rabbi in the future?
No, I haven't seen that one.
And Kyle thinks it's like a giant ploy just to fuck with him because he's always making fun of the Jews. So it's hilarious. It's
hilarious.
But I quote South Park all the time. I'm glad you do too, Corey. This is awesome.
It's a conversation that, like, I try to avoid at all costs because it really just doesn't fucking help the conversation at all. Right. I mean, it's the ultimate black pill, really. And so Kennedy, it's kind of hard to separate Kennedy from that because those are the people who were behind the assassination, right? When you come to understand the relationship between the Israelis, the CIA, and the Mafia, they're one organization in 1963, inseparable. And the amount of, like, traitorous espionage that went on, like, on multiple continents because of those organizations and their relationships with, like, the Corsican Mafia. And, like, then they have, like, a corporate infrastructure through businesses like – it was a company called Permandex. Mm-hmm. Which was a Mossad front company. And basically they were like the oversight board for assassinations. And the oversight board was the board of directors was like a who's who of like mob guys, CIA guys, intelligence guys, like you just every fucking possible scumbag had representation inside of Permandex. And so Permandex, which was founded by a guy named George Mandel, AKA George Mantello, he basically was a Mossad spy. He's hailed as like a hero during the Holocaust, but that's all like bullshit, you know, cover story. He founded Permandex basically so they could fund right-wing organizations in Europe to undermine democracies, right? That's what they did. And so they're responsible for numerous attempts on the life of Charles de Gaulle. There was actually a movie made about it called Day of the Jackal. Day of the Jackal came out in the 1970s, shortly after these events happened. Mm. Kind of interesting. Kind of makes you think, how did Hollywood get some inside information to make these movies so shortly after these assassination attempts occurred? And then you come to think about it, and you're like, oh, yeah, Jack Valente was the man running Hollywood from 66 to like 2007, 40 years he ran Hollywood. And he was the shooter on the grassy knoll. Okay. And so when you come to understand the relationships of these people and like the intertangledness between the media and intelligence, and it's just like the world is such a scary fucking place and nobody has any idea, really. Where was I? I have a tendency to go off on tangents, so you'll have to rein me back in every once in a while.
That was a solid tangent to go down. I mean, you're speaking of Permindex, and they owned a subsidiary of theirs, if I'm not mistaken, was either Hotels or Resorts International.
They owned Centro Mundial Comercial was the only subsidiary, and Centro Mundial Comercial was basically it owned stock. Basically, it bought stock in companies that were manufacturing parts for nuclear reactors or energy or oil. And that's all they did. They were a funneler of money, and they hid the funneling of the funding for the assassination through other trade deals that they did for commodities and things like that. But that's all they did. But no, they owned, there was like Hilton Hotels, Hyatt Hotels, like all these hotel companies were all in bed with the CIA. The CIA recruited so many people, and they really did it mostly when they were the OSS during World War II, because they recruited 40,000 plus people in 4 years during the war. And so then the CIA, quote unquote, isn't there until 47. But then in 47, all those recruitments from the OSS days, they just pulled back into their network. And when in 47, when the CIA flipped on the lights, they immediately had networks in the multi-millions around the world that they could access instantaneously. So when people would try to wonder how they gained so much power, like right away, that's how they did it, by recruiting Nazis and their entire spy networks, and by recruiting businessmen, by recruiting former heads of governments who still had influence. You know, like by the time the CIA came about in 47, which really was the product of Reinhard Gehlen, you had like Bill Donovan and Alan Dulles and Angleton and those guys who were the big shots in the OSS, but like they seemingly lacked guidance. And so after the war, they cut a deal with Reinhard Gehlen, right? So Adolf Hitler's spy master and the head general in the German army, who eventually they will put back in charge of German intelligence in 47 or 48, which is hilarious. But between 45 and 47, these guys were down in South America with over 200,000 fucking Nazis that they had smuggled out of Africa, North Africa, and Europe, like prior to paperclip. Lines. Everyone talks about fucking paperclip. Paperclip is a joke compared to I can't recall the operation's name before. It might have been like Avalanche or something like that. I don't remember it. But there was an operation to smuggle the fucking Nazis out of Europe and Africa, and they smuggled about 230,000 of them into South America. And then those Nazis went on to become what was called the Gehlen Organization. And the Gehlen Organization is like the one organization in the world no one ever knows about, no one ever talks about, and has shaped the world to a degree that would blow your fucking mind. Like, the Gehlen Organization is responsible for creating NATO, the 17 intelligence agencies, including the BND, which is the German intelligence agency, which then, you know, after being the top German fucking spy, Alan Dulles puts him back in charge of German intelligence and basically managing over this new alliance under like the United Nations and NATO and all that stuff. Right. So initially NATO
was for like the job. Huh?
Oh, yeah. But he fucking played them so well, because what he did was like he had all of Germany's intelligence, but he didn't just give it to him. He like had his men bury it like the Nazi gold, like, and they took, because that back then it was all on paper, right? Like, and so they took paper in huge boxes and crates and just buried it all over fucking Europe. And that was his bargaining chip. And I don't even know that all of it has been recovered at this point. Just so we know, the Nazi gold hasn't all been recovered. I mean, perhaps it has, and we just don't know about it. But yeah, that's how Reinhard Gehlen got his foothold in American intelligence. And he basically went on to form the security state that we live under today. So if you want to understand why the world seems like it's run by a bunch of fucking Nazis, it's because it was built by Nazis.
I have one question. I don't know if it ties into anything. The CIA was founded in 47.
Correct.
From the OSS. And then in 48, Israel, the state, is formed. Is there, correct, is there any type of, I mean, to me, that looks like a coincidence.
Yes,
to me.
These are all the same people. No. Like, you can't, don't even try to separate these people. Like, they might be different governments, different religions, whatever. These people are one organization that basically formed the cabal that still is today. I mean, you can trace these people's actions from immediately after World War II, especially like the fucking Israelis, I call them the Israelis because even though the Israel isn't around yet, it's this, literally the same fucking people causing havoc going back to like the 20s, right? So even before World War II, it's the fucking Israelis like Ben Gurion and Chaim Weizmann and all of these fucking guys, like worst people that have ever walked planet Earth.
So doesn't it go back way for me to say, and I might get a little bit of heat for this, that the Palestinians are actually the good guys in this situation over there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a given. But the reality is the original Israelites were black, right. black Africans. So You know, all the alleged traditions and cultures that go back 5,000 years, they don't. They go back about 1,500 years to about the, really about 550 AD with the codification of the Babylonian Talmud, which has nothing to do with the black Israelites who fucking basically went extinct post 70 AD. So allegedly 70 AD, you have the expulsion of the Jews, which they weren't even called Jews back then. They were expelled from Palestine at the, when the temple was destroyed, right? But this is like, where modern day Palestine is, right? And so all these people who had been, see, the original location of Palestine, the original location of the first temple, there's a lot of evidence that indicates it wasn't even in modern Palestine. It was actually in a region of northern Ethiopia. And that would kind of align with the Ethiopians who claim to have the ark in a fucking temple there, right? So the original, when you look at things like the Shushan temple, right? Right. And so when you look at all the original Hebrew artifacts and all the original impressions and paintings, and they all indicate that these were black people, like with big afros and big afro beards and stuff, like had nothing to do. There were no fucking white people who were slaves in Egypt 5,000 years ago. It's just a fucking joke. But yeah, like the Khazarians were an empire unto themselves, and kind of like Genghis Khan is described as an empire of tents, right? Like they were. They followed a religion called Tangridism, which was kind of like a black magic shamanistic kind of thing. It's the same thing that Attila the Hun and those guys all were a part of. The word on the street, and nobody really knows, because a lot of these old documents pertaining to Khazaria have been destroyed. Wonder why. So there's not a lot of really verifiable history. There's only a couple books that have some things that were translated from, you know, other books from hundreds of years ago. So it's really hard to pin down, but it appears as though the Khazarians, the Khazarian Empire, the leadership was forced to convert to one of the Abrahamic religions, right? And so they picked Judaism, and they were basically forced to stick with it. And they adopted the new Babylonian Talmud, but they kind of melded it with their black magic practices, right? And so these were the original white Jews in the world, period. There were no white Jews on the planet until 740 AD when these Khazarians converted, right? But allegedly they integrated their black magic practices into the religion itself, right? They kind of made this hybridization, and that is eventually what became modern day Judaism. Mm-hmm. And so and you have, see, what you have is in about 1200, 1220 AD, you have the Russians. So they were pre-Soviets, right? So you have the Russian Empire. And so they've just basically had enough of the Khazarians, and they invade and they force the Khazarians to scatter. And so this completely coincides with the timing of if you see in the history books about the great influx of white Jews into Europe settling in Poland and Germany and other places, right? So the expulsion of the Khazarians completely coincides with the modern history of the Jewish influx in the 13th century.
Oh, shit. Now I can kind of see, I'm going to get heat again.
Yeah, I get heat for this all the time. And this is just real history. This isn't like my opinions on anything.
No, we don't want these fuckers. And get the fuck out.
Right. And that around the 1200s is when you start to see the cases of ritual murder start to pop up throughout Europe. You don't see that before 1200s.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which also coincides. And so when you look at the history of the Jewish people post 1200 AD, they've been run out of 116 or 117 countries. Like thousands of cities have run them out of town for failure to integrate, unethical business practices, and also suspicion of ritual murders, which really still go on to this very day. And I will tell you, up to and including the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were all conducted in a manner consistent with Jewish ritual sacrifice. So, and that I can screen share. That I can show you some things if you want to see.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Give me about a minute to pull all of my stuff up. I wasn't going to do much screen share. It gets harder and harder on me to do this stuff.
Well, while you look up your stuff, I would say, to Ghost, I don't know if you remember when we were talking about we were talking about the Pilgrim Society, you and I were, and then we talked about, separately, I talked about, you know, the Safari Club and all this stuff. And the Safari Club comes out of a lot of the shit that Permindex was doing. And
can you name any of the members of the Safari Club?
There's, well, Salem Bin Laden, right? I mean, he was involved. There's quite a few.
There was a Moroccan involved. Do you remember the name of the Moroccan general involved?
No, but I do remember the Saudi arms dealer.
Okay. The Moroccan general, real quick, the Moroccan general involved was a guy named Ahmed Dalimi. And Ahmed Dalimi was also the dark complected man in Dealey Plaza who was next to the Umbrella Man.
Oh my God. So this is why he gets that spot, is because of,
he was a Mossad assassination coordinator back then. You see, the relationship between Morocco and Israel was super tight because there was a big influx of Sephardic Jews in Morocco. And so Israel knew that they could exploit that in their relationship with them, and they did. And so for a long time, you had a very tight intelligence relationship between Morocco. They were in the fold with us included, but the fold kind of fell apart sometime in the 1980s, you know, when we went into Afghanistan. Eventually, the cabal ended up at the time of 9/11 was Israel, Saudis, and us, right? After the many, you know, decades of changes. But in the modern era, it's us and Israel. That's it. That is fucking the whole world is us and Israel. And let me tell you what, America is not the one calling the shots.
Well, hey, buddy, it ain't us. It ain't the three of us, okay? Don't lump me in with them. You know, we're trying to be normal. I'm trying to make a little bit of money betting and doing a podcast. I'm not fucking with that.
Here's the thing. If Kanye would have just came out and maybe articulated his words a little bit better, kind of like what you're doing, Corey, and we are, he actually was probably stumbling onto some correct shit.
Right, but a lot of the people out there who just don't understand the things to articulate, right? My knowledge of this is really deep because I've been studying this for years, and most people can't say the same, right? So it's really difficult. You know, you might know a little bit, but not enough to be able to say, you know, this is the deal. Fortunately, I have made it a point to study those particular things.
Which I'm glad someone like you did, because I know a lot of this goes over my head in certain areas, but then in certain areas it's like, oh shit, you know, light bulbs just start fucking firing off and it's like, wow, okay, this is all making sense now. And all the connections that you know, I mean, it's a huge fucking spider web.
It's the biggest. The Kennedy is the center of the universe.
It seems like it was the beginning of a ritual too, like a long standing ritual, maybe not the beginning, but like more so with the United States, because you get like the first like credit card coming out around then as well, and like all kinds of weird shit kind of ties together.
And then
within
you
that.
Fast forward to 9/11, and you have the dancing Israelis, and it's making another ritual. It's like, fuck.
Okay, so this right here is a frame from the Robert Hughes film, and this has been tampered with. You really can't tell anything. Everybody has been smudged and blurred out, right? Like, you can clearly see, like right here, a face has been just smudged out with black ink, right? Mm-hmm. All these people are smudged. You can't see a damn thing, right? So, but these people like to leave a calling card. And so I did happen to find one single frame, this almost identical frame, but I realized that the frame that I found was not tampered with, and it looks like this. It's virtually a different picture.
Wow.
But it's the same thing. Like, when you go back and look, like, this is the person in this Greco-Roman style robes here, and you can clearly see a face on the person. But when you go back to this is the official standardized version. The face has been blacked out, right? So this is clearly tampered with. You can't see any details on anything. But when you zoom in here, well, number one, you can clearly see that's J.D. Tippit, the officer who's about to be shot at around 1 o'clock in Oak Cliff. He's standing on Houston Street. Like, nobody's ever pointed that out before. But as you go through this, like, assembly of people here standing on Houston Street, and you know this is at the time of the assassination, because this is the motorcycle cops who are behind Kennedy as the motorcade is pulling around the corner onto Elm Street, okay? So if you take a look on the right here, you'll see there's a person wearing a costume of a parrot. You can see the yellow head with the black eyes and the orange beak. I think there's some other people wearing costumes here, but I really can't say, you know, I'm not 100% sure, but I can tell you with certainty that is a parrot costume. And the most important person here in this lineup of people is this guy right here in the middle, who is wearing a very tall, ornate hat. It's kind of, it's purple and it has some like, looks like gold or silver on it. It has a white collar hanging out here, a purple robe, and this is a patch on the shoulder here. And you can see a couple other people with patches on the shoulder here, right? They're all, these people are all together. And so then you find like this group of four, right? It's a family of four, and they're right here in this photograph. Mm-hmm. When you look at what they're wearing, they're not wearing like normal clothes. They're wearing some kind of costume. Like this person in here, the son, it looks like a son and a father and a mother. And here's a daughter wearing like a black cape. Like they're obvious. He's wearing some sort of funky hat with a tall like thing on it.
Reminds me of a Bobby.
Right. That's exactly what I thought. Like a Bobby. Right. So it's a costume of some kind. And so this was kind of like weirding me out. And so when you zoom in on this guy right here, you can kind of see like a little clearer. This person here looks, they're wearing Greco-Roman style robes. You have one person with this tall, funky hat. Here's another one right here. And here's a third one down a little bit further. And you can see the big open collar here. And this one has an open collar here with the white shirt underneath. And it definitely, to me, looked like a guy in purple robes and a patch on the shoulder. And so when I really kind of understood like what was going on here, I realized all these people with arrows above their head are wearing ornate outfits or some kind of costume. And like no one had ever brought this up to me before. And so then you go up to like the grassy knoll and you see like this is from the seconds immediately after the shooting. you have these kids up here and this kid has like tassels on his shoulder and like the inlay of his jacket on the front comes all the way down to the bottom.
Almost looks like
and a so I'm like
outfit.
Right, is exactly it. I thought it was like a marching band. I'm like, What is up with this fucking, what is going on here, right? And I'm going to skip a bunch of these pictures here. And then I find this here in the back of the Robert Hughes film. Now, this only took up about an inch in the back of the video itself, of the film itself. But someone's getting arrested back here. And it looked like they look like the Wicked Witch of the West. Like they're wearing some kind of like, look like the witch outfit, right?
Hell? Yeah. Look at this. It's very pronounced, too.
Very pronounced, right? A big witch's hat. And I'm like, why are people wearing costumes? At the Kennedy assassination, we got a parrot, we got a witch, right? And so this is kind of a zoom in on it. You can see it a little more pronounced. And I realized that this person here was Clyde Haygood, who was the cop who ran up the knoll a couple minutes after the shooting. When you read his statements and go through what really happened from witnesses and all that, because he ends up lying about it after the fact. All these cops who actually did stuff had their testimony like force changed, and then Clyde Haygood actually ends up getting in a one car accident and suffered brain damage, and so he never talked again. But yeah, that's Clyde Haygood on the right, and he's arresting what looks like the Wicked Witch of the West. But then I realized that like that's not the Wicked Witch of the West, like that is some sort of Hasidic Jewish hat and like this, and that the robe they're wearing is like this. It's a Hasidic Jewish ceremonial robe and hat. So let's go back and take another look at it. Now it makes a little bit more sense, right? And here you have two more Jews in Hasidic garb with white scarves on. And you can tell this, and when you watch the video, it's a little more clear, but they're also wearing these big round Hasidic hats that they wear. So you have all these Jews up back on behind the grassy knoll within seconds of the assassination. Then I realized in the video, when you watch this, these two little spots that I have clear, it doesn't look like people, but they're actually moving, right? And then when you read the statements of Joe Smith, what he did after the assassination, when he runs back in the railroad yards, it became clear to me that this was Joe Smith and he had a suspect proned out underneath the car. Now I know that Joe Smith took somebody into custody because this is him right here on the right. And he took this person into custody and he's walking them down. This is the slope of the grassy knoll after the assassination, probably by about 2 or 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 minutes after the assassination, he's walking this person down. And I kind of concluded based on the statements that he made that and the motion here of this, that this is where Joe Smith took his suspect into custody. And this is where he got arrested. Now, this person went on to be held for 3 weeks. Long after Lee Harvey Oswald was killed, Bill Decker was trying to put charges on this guy, couldn't hold him on anything related to the president, tried putting local charges on him. And after 3 weeks, they had to let this guy go. I have not confirmed his identity, but I have my suspicions. So really what is going on here is, this is a Purim ritual ceremony. And now Purim, when you study, the Jewish holidays, Purim is the tale of Esther and a king named Haman. And basically, Haman was going to kill all the Jews. And so Esther and Mordecai, they pray to God, and they get all the Jewish people to fast. And God intervenes, and Haman is killed, and the Jews are saved. So Purim is the ceremony. It's a celebration of the salvation of the Jewish people from Haman. The way I interpret it is the celebration of the preemptive slaughter of their enemies. And so when you look at a modern day Purim ceremony on the left, you've got the same exact thing, the tall hats with the design, the purple robes, the patch on the shoulder, the big white collar. This is a Jewish ritual sacrifice, a symbolic Purim ceremony. And why are they doing a Purim ceremony? Well, because Kennedy is akin to Haman, because Kennedy was going to cut all aid to Israel, and he was going to prevent the Israelis from getting the bomb. And so they believe that this was no different than Haman ordering a decree to kill all the Jews, right? So Kennedy was going to prevent them from getting the bomb, which they believed would ultimately lead to the destruction of Israel and the Jewish people. Therefore, the killing of Kennedy was akin to the killing of Haman, the preemptive slaughter of their enemy, which is exactly what they did. Because make no mistake about it, Kennedy was going to shut down that whole fucking state. And we know this going back to what's called the Battle of Letters. The Battle of Letters between Kennedy and Ben-Gurion in May of 63, where Kennedy is demanding access to the Dimona nuclear reactor in the Negev Desert. Now, the Israelis had been building a nuclear bomb factory since the late 1950s. They were helped by the French. They were helped by the Galen Organization out of Argentina. And in 1960, Time Magazine publishes an article stating that the Israelis are building nukes. 20, 30 years later, you get Mordecai Vanunu, who smuggled photographs out of the facility in the Negev Desert called Dimona. And they basically published those. And then the whole world knew that the Israelis were, in fact, building nuclear weapons, and they deny it still to this very day. This is the reason why Kennedy was killed. And when you look back at the timing, the Battle of Letters, where basically Ben-Gurion told Kennedy to go fuck yourself, you're not going to get anybody in to inspect our nuclear reactor. He told him that because he knew the assassination was already in the works, because the Walker shooting happened on April 10th, and the Walker shooting was the shooting at General Edwin Walker's house, which is meant to set up Lee Harvey Oswald as the patsy in the assassination. That happened more than a month before the Battle of Letters, indicating the plot to kill Kennedy was well underway. I put the plot to kill Kennedy as having been finalized somewhere around February of 1963, because in March of 1963, we have Oswald allegedly ordering the rifle and the handgun to a P.O. box. However, he never ordered the rifle, nor did he order the handgun, because problems with the P.O. box, problems with the money order. It was obviously a false trail leading to Oswald. And that all happened long before the Battle of Letters in May of 63. So we can definitely say with certainty the plot to kill Kennedy was on for at least 9 or 10 months, probably slightly even longer. I believe that there was a board meeting of Permandex. All that says is in spring of 1963. And I have no doubts that that meeting of Permandex, which I believe was in America in New York City, I believe that was when the finalization of the plans to kill Kennedy were put into place. And then everyone was like, everyone to fulfill their roles at that time. The CIA had things to do. The mob had things to do. Even the Israelis had things to do via Jack Ruby, because Jack Ruby was directly connected to Meyer Lansky. The people were like, oh, well, Jack Ruby was a Jew. He couldn't have been in the fucking mob. What a bunch of dummies. So Jack Ruby worked directly for Meyer Lansky. He was connected to all the big mob bosses. He was connected to Giancana in Chicago, and Giancana worked for a guy named Hyman Lerner. Hyman Lerner was the Jew who controlled the mob in Chicago, and Giancana was a front boss. And so, yeah, Jack Ruby was so high up in the mob that he was outside all the bounds of the Sicilians, right? Mm-hmm. So he would directly do things for Meyer Lansky or Hyman Lerner or this the Jewish controlling sect of the mob. That is who Jack Ruby worked for. So
it's crazy.
Yeah. I forget where I was going.
You're on
with
a
this.
Roll here, dude. You mentioned something about the railroad right behind the whole area that this was. This was behind the book. So,
the book depository. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So this railroad, because this was what was interesting when I was looking through this, and I kind of mentioned this to you earlier. I'm obviously not as educated on this stuff as you are, but this Gordon Arnold dude that
he was standing had, in front of the he was standing in front of the fence and he says the bullets went over his head and then
he
someone
said
came
one
around
went past his ear, which was right. interesting. And then he goes on, so he's filming, right? He's trying to get like a good vantage point. He thought that the whole situation that he was going to go film was just a parade, but then he finds out later that Kennedy's going to be there, tries to get a good spot to film. He's trying to get a good in a good area, but a CIA agent supposedly flashes his badge at him, says you can't come up here, go somewhere else. He stands near the grassy knoll, from what I understand. A bullet whizzes past him, and then he hits the deck, and a police officer without a hat, which is interesting. Maybe the hat fell off in some chaos or whatever, but a police officer approaches Arnold here and says, I need your video footage. Mm-hmm. And then he goes, that this police officer, according to Arnold, goes to that railroad station and meets up with someone working at the railroad, and then gives him the camera, gives him all the footage. And the guy never gets his footage back. Is that true?
Right. It's possible. No, I mean, we can't say with certainty, but the things he say are they don't conflict with how I've put together the flow of the assassination. So, yeah, but there's no real evidence that he was there. It's just that his statements are seemingly in line with what I have put together.
And I'm sure that you've seen this photo, right? This one of it's enhanced.
Yeah, that's nonsense. Yeah, it's
you don't
junk.
Think it's real?
No, I know it's not.
Okay. Why is that?
Yeah, because I know who the shooters were and I know where they were. And I know that there was not a police officer in uniform directly behind the fence line. So,
okay.
But so let me get back to the ritual aspect. So on the photo on the left of the kids on the grassy knoll, the photo on the right are Jewish children wearing Purim ceremonial outfits. You'll notice the same tassels on the shoulder and the inlay that goes down the front of the outfit. So these lunatic fucking occultists brought their children to see Canada. And he get his head blown off, right? They knew he was going to, all the crowd there knew because they were all Jews who were really, and the way I see it is these guys are not like normal Jews. These are occultist fucking wacko Jews who are digging into like pre-Abrahamic Canaanite religion stuff, right? That's where the overlap between the Egyptian gods and the Canaanite pagan deities and Baal and Set and all that stuff, like all kind of intermingle in this kind of weird Jewish occultists. The way I kind of compare these people is like the number of Muslims who are actual jihadists is like so fucking small. It's a fraction of a percent. And I would put the number of like of these weirdo occultists within Judaism at the same thing, a fraction of a percent. But I can tell you almost with certainty that this was coordinated through Meyer Lansky's rabbi. There's a lot of government FBI documents, particularly in some CIA, on Meyer Lansky's rabbi that I still need to get to. But that would be the connection, because when you go back to like the assassination of Mayor Anton Cermak in 1931, or was it? No, that was 33. Anton Cermak is murdered in Miami, 1933. He's the mayor of Chicago. He was basically had a beef with Al Capone. And then after Al Capone, Frank Nitti. And fundamentally, a hit is put out on him. And while he is with Roosevelt in Miami, the hit is pulled off by a guy named Dave Yaris, who was actually one of the shooters in the Kennedy assassination. Dave Yaris, a young 19-year-old kid who's sent from Chicago to Miami to work the liquor lines for Prohibition, he ends up getting a guy named Zangara, Giuseppe Zangara, to be the patsy in this assassination. And when you really dig through the pictures in that assassination, you'll find these Purim rabbis there also in 1933, 30 fucking years before Kennedy was killed. So yeah, this is not new. This is not an aberrant occurrence. This is modus operandi for these people. And I promise you, there are these Purim rabbis in the Ambassador Hotel with Robert Kennedy. I promise you they're around somewhere around Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all of these. These are all conducted in a manner that coincide with Jewish ritual sacrifice. So
now, I'm going to back this up many, many, many years. that ritual worship of supposed when Moses went up to get the Ten Commandments, it comes down, they build the golden calf. Okay. And he's like, oh, you can't be worshiping this and da 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 da. What is the correlation? Because I've been thinking about this for probably a month now since they found these red heifers. Okay. Why are they still so adamant about cow worship? And does that like, maybe I'm just like,
that I'm, I know what you're talking about. I really can't comment on that too much, but I'll kind of explain to you how I kind of see the divergence here from the kind of traditional Orthodox Judaism that follows the Torah and the these kind of like modern day Jews who follow the Talmud, because there's a big difference, right? So there's a sect, it's about 10% of Jews around the world who are extreme Orthodox, and they fucking hate Israel. They hate the Zionists. And they are very against Talmudic Judaism, right? Because the Torah is good stuff. It's the Ten Commandments, right? It's like, don't steal, don't fuck your neighbor's wife, you know, don't, no, it's all that stuff, right? All that, don't kill people, whatever. So, but that's not the Talmud. So you have Moses who goes up and gets the Ten Commandments, right? And so the Torah eventually comes from the Ten Commandments. Waiting at the base of the mountain, you had like 70 rabbis, and they end up writing all the other shit that has nothing to do with the Torah. It's their interpretations of how to execute the Torah in daily life, and that was called the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin is the original documents that are basically these 70 rabbis' interpretation of the Torah, okay? And so, but they add, of course, they're humans, and so they add all their own shit to it, and all this crazy shit. And that, the Sanhedrin, over time, after the destruction of the temple and all that stuff, you know, hundreds or thousands of years later, eventually the Sanhedrin gets incorporated into the Babylonian Talmud, which really has nothing to do with the ancient Israelites who, from what I can tell, went extinct in 70 AD. So after 70 AD, what you have is you have a more, how do I say this? I don't want to say enlightened, but the elitist classes of the day who were more Middle Easterner in Egypt and throughout Palestine, they were Middle Easterners. They were not black Africans, right? They adopted these ways going back to like before the time of Jesus, who wasn't a real person. And then by the time 550 comes around, they've kind of collected, this, I think it's 72 total books, including the Sanhedrin and a whole bunch of other stuff. And that eventually becomes the Babylonian Talmud. And when you read through it, it's a fucking book that basically is very anti-Christian. It endorses all kinds of ritual sacrifice. And yeah, I don't know how I got on this tangent, but like, well, I mean, it's a disgusting fucking book. And when you go and like, one thing I want to connect to modern day, when you read like statements from people like Tal Zaks, who was the head of fucking Moderna, who says his inspiration for creating the vaccine was the Talmud. It's like, what the fuck are you crazy fucking people talking about? So these sicko occultists are still around today running major companies.
Well, they didn't even have the damn virus when they created that vaccine either. They admit, I know, that Moderna specifically. That's the French guy, if I'm not mistaken, right? So yeah, just a weird, weird thing. Corey, you were mentioning something though, and I stepped away briefly, but you know, the idea that everyone at this ritual of JFK being sacrificed was essentially Jewish. Obviously there's your onlookers that have, right, nothing to do with the ritual, right?
Correct.
But the media and like more, you know, mainstream stories about this, they point to figures like this babushka lady, right? Which, I mean, that kind of makes you think that, you know, maybe she was some part of the ritual. Is that, you know, just deliberate misdirection?
Yeah, I think so, because like when you look at all the pictures that have been put forth over the years of having been the babushka lady, it's clearly like four or five different women that they've put, okay, forth, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, they say that there's one lady in particular. I forget
there is one lady in particular, and she's standing on the lawn and you can see her like taking pictures or filming or whatever. She's never been identified. You can clearly see her face from another film that's taken from up the grassy knoll as she goes running up the steps, and it's like some old woman. Now,
Beverly Oliver.
It's not Beverly Oliver. She's a fucking, she's a liar and an attention whore. She is not the fuck. She would have been 17 at the time. And when you listen to her descriptions, her conflicting descriptions over the years of where she was standing, if she was even in Dealey Plaza at all, it's most likely she was standing on Houston Street, not anywhere near the fucking place where she says. Definitely not where the Babushka lady is, but yeah, it's really kind of pissed me off to a great degree that so many people have credited her with being the Babushka lady when the various photographs that have been put forth as the Babushka lady are definitely different women. And the one person who it is definitely in her 60s, if not older. And
like I said, it's just deliberate misdirection is what it
is. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, they put emphasis on things that don't matter, right? Like, sure. I swear to God, if I hear another person say that, like, James Files or, like, Malcolm Wallace had anything to do with the assassination, I'm going to fucking lose it. Like, this is COINTELPRO. This what is about FBI Bush? Infiltration. Bush was in Dallas. He was definitely in Dealey Plaza.
He says 100%. He wasn't. Wasn't the
no. So
Bin
here's Laden the thing, family? Bush. Oh, no,
never mind. That's 9/11.
We have a letter from Barbara Bush, his wife, who basically admits that they flew a private plane up to fucking Dallas from Houston. That George Bush dropped her off at a beauty salon, and she was getting her hair done when Kennedy was killed. About a half an hour after the assassination, so probably about 1 o'clock. George Bush comes and picks her up from the hair salon in Dallas, and they rush to a private airport. Okay. Now, this is probably 1:15-ish, 1:20-ish. Now, this timing of Barbara Bush's story completely coincides with a story involving Redbird Airport, which is a small kind of private airport in Dallas. Barbara Bush describes how they headed back to the small airport. They got on a private plane, which belonged to Mr. Zoppo, who was one of the guys who owned the Dallas Morning News, which all checks out. They then had to fly to Love Field, and then they had to return to the airport and then fly back to Love Field. And she describes this because they were dropping people off and picking people up. And this is exactly what's described by the operator at Redbird Airport, how a plane took off, said it was going one direction, ended up going the opposite direction, ended up at Love Field, returned from Love Field, and then took off again. So I'm concluding that the story Barbara Bush tells coincides with the Redbird Airport story, which would make perfect sense. And ultimately, they fly back to Houston on a private on a public commercial plane from Dallas Love Field. So,
dude, the foresight that the Bushes had, though, man, to you know, not implicate themselves in this is wild. I mean, they have like false you know, recollections of the past written down in journals. I know that Bush supposedly also like tried to rat out one of his friends for the killing of JFK. If you remember, I forget.
Yeah, that's the story of James Parrott. It's really kind of, to me, it's doesn't really. I don't put a lot of. I mean, it's definitely interesting, but it doesn't really answer anything. It just shows that George Bush was trying to create an alibi and deflect attention to someone else. I mean,
so do you think he was a key player? Bush Senior was a key player.
Bush, you gotta think, you gotta understand his role in the CIA at the time. He was he was an oil guy, right? He was a private sector oil guy, and the CIA had a need for private sector oil guys who had access to ports and boats for smuggling, because the CIA is a fucking smuggling operation.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in the 60s, 50s, you know, post World War II and 1947 when they came about, like those guys, they were using like fucking Disney on Ice and Ice Capades as smuggling operations. You know, I mean, like, people don't understand how vast their network was, and that was basically what it was about. And so when you had a guy like George Bush who could provide ships for international smuggling, who had the ships, who had money, you know, you pull him into the CIA and you get him involved in operations, but he's not out there handling people. He's a money guy. Bush was elite, right? So
yeah, Eastern establishment, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but see, why was Bush in
Texas?
If that's the case, then why was Bush in Dealey Plaza? If he's just a money guy, why is he there? Because they were all there. It was a fucking spectacle. All of them were there.
Also, they all wanted to make sure that they like wouldn't rat on each other, even though it seemed like Bush allegedly tried to do this. But
there was that, but I think it was just they all had to be there for whatever weird, you know, for whatever weird they had to see for like themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we all have to be a part of this.
There's a lot of things that went on that were clearly like that, like clearly initiation style, right? Like Jack Valente. So Jack Valente is the shooter on the grassy knoll. And so when you come to understand that and come to understand who Jack Valente is, Jack Valente went on to run Hollywood for fucking 40 years. He became the head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. Jack Valente created the rating system for fucking movies in this country. And he shot Kennedy from the knoll. And I can prove it. And so, see, they kind of hid him in plain sight, right? Let's say any evidence came out that implicated Jack Valente. Oh, Jack Valente, the guy who runs the movies? He shot Kennedy? Ha ha, you're crazy, right? Like, look at Chuck Barris. Chuck Barris came out and said he was a CIA assassin. He was the fucking host of the Gong Show, right? I have no doubts he was a CIA assassin.
Well, dude, let's go through this. If you don't mind, let's go through this kind of like step by step and really slowly, because this is fascinating to me that the dude that is so influential in Hollywood is actually the gunman here. Mm-hmm. And yep. I'd never heard this theory, but yeah,
he's so much more than the gunman. He's so much more than the gunman. So I'll start with Jack when he was 15 years old. When Jack was 15 years old, 1936, his very first job is working for Humble Oil, owned by Prescott Bush. And okay. he was what was called a hall boy. That's how he started, at least. So he would run memos and he would run mail back and forth, and he just whatever errands people needed.
A hand job here and there, whatever.
I think you're hitting onto something else there. Yes, I think that Jack got passed around because Jack was gay as fuck. Like, that's not what the official story says, but when you come to understand who Jack Valenti was, he was gayer than a fucking $3 bill.
I was just guessing, but shit, I nailed down the head, huh?
And you got to think, these guys fuck kids. They traffic in children.
Yeah, yeah, unfortunately.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, 15 years old, he goes to work for Humble Oil. He goes to high school in Houston. And then he goes to the University of Texas at Houston. And from there, 1942-ish, he's still working for Humble Oil, and he's going to school at night, but the war breaks out. And so he has to go to World War II, right? So this fucking guy, you can tell he's already got connections by the time he joins the Air Force, right? He's part of the Air Corps. When you really dig into his record, he's allegedly flew 51 bombing missions, and was like a war hero and all this shit. But really, when you dig into where he was during the fucking war, he was stationed in like Arizona training to be he was training to be a pilot, training to do all this stuff. And then he ends up getting, discharged before the war is even over in like early 45. Right.
Stolen valor.
So when I look at stolen valor. Like, the fucking guy probably never left America. If anything, he flew to fucking Europe for like a day and came back. But the vast majority of the time, he was allegedly a bombing hero. He was here in America doing what? I think he was doing sniper training for the fucking CIA. Because we have no evidence he flew a plane. Like, you can't find any of those records. When you look at where he allegedly was, the bombing group he was allegedly associated with, his name is not listed anywhere.
What makes you lean towards the sniping training? Obviously,
well, because he fucking killed Kennedy and he was a hell of a shot. Plus, I have my suspicions. Okay, so Jack Valenti ultimately is part of the CIA, and that I can prove because of documents. Well, actually, I'll prove it right now. Let me see.
While you're looking for that, one thing I want to mention, because I feel like I'm just interrupting every time, Corey, so it's not my intention.
Fine.
I'm just trying to jump in. Supposedly there's a tape recordings analyzed of four shots, and a lot of people think that there were only three shots that were fired there in the plaza.
Oh, but no.
There's in fact four. Is there?
It was way more than that. It was at least six or seven, and could be up to as many as 10. Really? They recovered at least five bullets. So yeah, they're completely full of shit. When you go through the actual documents, the documents completely contradict what the official story is. Like,
and we did you see we as have well? Conspiracy theories.
You know that what was that, Ghost?
I said, and we wonder why we have conspiracy theorists.
Well, yeah, because we can't get a damn straight answer. I mean, in the 90s, A&E ran a special as well, and they said that a French hit squad was in charge of doing this. That was hired
okay.
By,
so, yeah, let me talk about that real quick. So, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about Joe West and his investigation into the Corsicans. And here's the thing: the Corsican stuff is very real. However, the Corsicans were not shooters. The CIA hired killers from all the fuck over the place to come to Texas and just hang out. Like, Hank Alborelli wrote a couple great books. Hank died last year, but his last book is called Coup in Dallas. And he identified the Corsican assassins who were in Dealey Plaza and in Dallas.
Those the Frenchies?
Day.
The French?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, the French. But they were not shooters. They were there to muddy the waters. So the CIA is not a bunch of idiots. They understand how investigations work. And like, when they had people come in from all over the world, there were at least a dozen mob guys walking around Dealey Plaza. They had the Corsicans. There's rumors of Mexican assassins that had come in. When the FBI goes and does their fucking pulling, what possible gunmen were in Dealey Plaza or Dallas that week? They're going to find like 30 of them, right? And so where's their investigation then?
All 30.
All 30, right. So, and what's that going to do? It's going to get them spinning their gears, going nowhere, right?
Because it makes it so that there's so many different possibilities to where you can't settle on one. And so that's why I find this interesting. And I'm not disagreeing with you at all, but I just find it interesting that you feel that you know 100% that 100%. You know who shot. And this is what I'm very interested to hear.
Yeah,
for sure. So
remember, it all goes back to relationships, right? Relationships are key. Relationships are everything. So Jack Valenti, so he goes off to college and he goes to the war. Something happens during the war, but I don't think he ever actually goes there. He comes back from the war, finishes up at the University of Texas at Houston, and then he applies to Harvard Business School. But he was kind of a shitty student. He was like a B student. So he applies to Harvard Business School and he gets rejected. Well, instead of sending a letter to the dean, he actually flies up to fucking Boston and he goes and meets with this guy in person. And after 3 days, his rejection letter is now an acceptance letter. And not only that, he's put into like the highest honors program that there is at the school. When he got rejected for being a B student in the fucking first place. So who was it in 1948 pulling strings? Or who was it? Actually, this is 46. Who was in Harvard pulling strings, running student organizations with their foot in the door of the intelligence community in 46?
Bush.
Henry Kissinger.
Oh, shit. Close. Same Close. Thing.
Yeah.
Same thing. It is fucking identical. It's really the same thing. So Henry Kissinger is fucking at Harvard Business School, running student organizations, recruiting for the CIA or intelligence in general, because the CIA isn't around yet. But Kissinger is already in those circles by 46. So he pulls by 48 when fucking Valenti graduates from Harvard with a master's degree. Him and Kissinger become lifelong friends after that. That puts Valenti in the upper echelon of global pull in that sphere of influence. Like, it doesn't get any higher than that.
I know Kissinger is Ryan's favorite dude of all time.
Kissinger is, though. I was gonna say, Corey, do you think pound for pound worst human of all time, maybe Kissinger, maybe worse than Hitler? Even
Hitler, we're not going to talk about Hitler today, but okay. Not Hitler is fucking Mahatma Gandhi compared to Kissinger.
Thank you Yeah, I stand behind that. I think he's the worst fucking person of all time.
And so quite, very, quite possibly. Very, very possibly. if ever there was a facilitator of the New World Order, quote unquote, it was him. Going back to probably in the womb. That guy was probably evil in the fucking womb.
He's an advocate for using nukes. Not just having them, but using them.
He's nukes. One of those guys who wants there to be 500,000 people in the world controlling everything, and 500,000, you know, and then everybody else is a slave. Like, that's what these people want, ultimately.
Wild. But yeah, let's get back to this fellow that's in charge of
So 48, he graduates Harvard Business School, and he is basically, from then on out, it's really strange, because there's no explanation for a lot of his activities. Like, for example, he is put in touch with a guy named Arthur Krim. And Arthur Krim is working in Hollywood with a guy named Lou Wasserman. And Lou Wasserman was running Universal, which at the time, that was when Universal had more power in Hollywood than anybody, right? The MPAA came along later, and Lou Wasserman was in control of Hollywood. And him and Jack Valenti ended up becoming great friends. Well, they put Jack Valenti as the government, as the go-between between Hollywood and the government on the film The Manchurian Candidate. Now, allegedly, Valenti has no history in government, and he has no experience in Hollywood. No, like, why would he get this key position? Obviously, because he was already plugged into those intelligence circles. Arthur Krim had a wife named Matilda Krim. Matilda Krim was having an affair with Johnson at the time the U.S. List Liberty was going on. So you can see this kind of closed circle of people. But yeah, so Jack Valenti is getting these jobs doing weird things, like coordinating Hollywood for the government when he supposedly has no experience in either, right? Obviously, he's doing this at the behest of the CIA. And then he opens up his permanent front job, which is Weekly and Valenti, which is a advertising firm down in Houston. And right from the get-go, he starts this in 19 let me see, must have been 53, 54. And immediately his clients were like Continental Oil, Humble Oil. He left Humble Oil to open up his own firm, an advertising firm, basically.
Again, that is Prescott Bush's.
Prescott Bush's, right. Okay. And so he, right off the bat, his advertising firm, his advertising agency starts getting the biggest clients in the fucking world, right? It's obvious he is connected in more ways than one just because of the level of business that he's getting from, you know, starting his own ad agency. He will run that ad agency through the 1950s up until November 22nd, 1963, when on November 22nd, 1963, he goes to work for Johnson in the White House as Johnson's right-hand man. He had been working with Johnson since 56, right? He had helped Johnson with his campaigns and as for like the Senator House or whatever the fuck Johnson was doing before he was the vice president. He got Kennedy's gig in 1960, doing the advertising and promotion for Kennedy's campaign, right? So Jack Valenti is a key figure in the world of politics post 1956 when he gets in with Lyndon Johnson. All right. Now, keep in mind, he was allegedly in the war. He's definitely plugged into intelligence communities. He went to Harvard. He's directly connected to Henry Kissinger all this entire time. Right. Then when I really start to dig through the Jack Valenti file, it really kind of rocked me, the things that they actually allowed to leak. So let me show you some of this stuff.
And when they show this stuff, I mean, you say yourself, you're surprised. Is he meant to be sort of a scapegoat for people that dig into this? Because obviously,
no. I think what happens is over the years, I think people in modern day who release files from 50 years ago, they don't know what the fuck they're releasing. They just don't. They don't understand. They're like, okay, Jack Valenti worked in the White House, big fucking deal, right? They don't understand the relevance of that to someone like me who understands like timing and the significance of timing of all the different things that he's done, right? So,
well, dude, when there's names being thrown around too, like, you know, the Bush family and these other, you know, Meyer Lansky and all these other things, dude, I haven't fucking ever heard of Jack Valenti myself. Mm-hmm.
Nobody
has. Fairly proficient when it comes to stuff like this, but
right.
No, like I said, there's levels to this, and I wonder if he's a scapegoat for people that are at a higher level of understanding with how the CIA worked during this era.
I don't think so. I think he was one of the protected ones. I think, okay. See, the Jack Valenti file wasn't released until 2018.
Wow. Okay. Didn't know that.
And it was released because of a FOIA from, what's the guy's name who does the Black Vault? The Black Vault website. He does hundreds and hundreds of FOIAs every year.
Okay.
He pulled this because it had something to do with the movies, right? He pulled Jack Valenti's file because it had movie stuff in it. And when I saw it, I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like, this is one of the most priceless files ever. I've probably been able to fill in the redactions on about a third of it. And there's about, I don't know, I'd say 200 to 300 pages that they never released, that they were intentionally withholding. But those just go to show relationships, because Jack Valenti got tied up in some interesting things while he was in the White House and out of the White House. But so December 12th,
John Greenwald.
Yeah. John Greenwald. Yeah.
Okay. So cool.
So December 12th, 63, they're doing background checks on all these people. And so remember Jack Valenti, his job up until November 22nd was running an advertising firm in Houston, no government job, period. Okay. But December 12th, 63, this is from C.D. DeLoach to Mr. Moore. This is an internal document within the FBI to, I believe, CIA. Mr. Moore is CIA, because I can't find a Mr. Moore who's a real name. Walter Jenkins called me from the White House at 1240. He mentioned that the president planned to move several people in federal agencies over on the White House payroll. Captioned individual is one of these people. Okay. So the captioned individual is Jack Valenti, and he had to be moved from a federal agency over onto the White House payroll. Well, what fucking federal agency could he possibly be working for if he was just running a goddamn advertising firm in Houston? There's only one, the CIA.
Yeah, you'd think the CIA for sure. But yeah, it's just, yeah, Ghost, that's wild, dude. I don't know if you caught that whole thing, man, but, you know, this first paragraph of this whole thing right here is...
I apologize. I did not. I had to break up a dog fight.
Lovely. Yeah. Lovely.
But you understand the significance of this document, right? I mean, it's basically them telling them that Jack Valenti's in a fucking federal agency. And the only federal agency it could have possibly been was a CIA, especially when you look at his history with Kissinger and having been in the military and all this stuff and him getting into Harvard. Like, it's obvious he's intelligence And there's only one intelligence agency really in this country that does anything valid, and that's the CIA. So
is it fair to be skeptical of everyone that graduates from Yale and Harvard and places like this?
Yes.
That's what I thought, man. It's so difficult to get into these places. They don't just take intelligent people. It seems like you have to be connected, and if you're going to actually graduate from these places,
I think these are just filtration mechanisms. They're recruiting and filtration mechanisms. That's it.
Very well said. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And so then when you further dig into Jack Valenti, like the FBI file, man, I'm telling you, everybody needs to read this thing. Like, I've read it like a lot, and there's still parts of it I can't figure out, but it's just so much. It's just a gift that keeps on giving. So FBI probed Hollywood's Jack Valenti for mob ties because he was born into two mob families. He was born into the Valenti family, which was connected to like Umberto Valenti, who was called the Ghost back in the 20s. He's related to a guy named Andrea Valenti out of Tampa. And that's important because Andrea Valenti was one of the other people arrested after the assassination of Mayor Anton Cermak in Miami. And that was coordinated through Traficante Sr., and Jack Valenti, I believe, was controlled through his mob ties under Traficante out of Tampa, Traficante Jr. Because I have some documents that indicate Traficante introduced a hitman named, quote-unquote, Max.
Well, there we go. Like I told you, banger information after banger information, right? You get 45 additional minutes of just mind-blowing stuff. Continuing to blow minds is Corey Hughes. And I really appreciate that. So if you want to hear all that and many more episodes, head over to patreon.com/dangerousworldpodcast. Ghost is also offering the additional 45 minutes on his Patreon as well. Thanks for the support, guys. Talk to you in a couple days here. Enjoy Thanksgiving.